Let me tell you, Stenton Friedman's always a great guest, isn't he? We'll be back with your phone calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Stan. I also understand you're going to be in Burlington, Wisconsin, in the end of October, around Halloween. What's happening there?
Yeah, they had a festival last year. There's a lot of strange stuff in Burlington: underground tunnels, you know, weird sort of stuff. And Mary Sutherland has put together. I was there last year, and I'll be there this year. Kathleen Martin will be there too, incidentally. And we're giving talks, and we'll visit some of these weird places. Now, some of this might have involved Al Capone. You know, you got to find a place to store the liquor and all that sort of thing. But there are some strange areas there. The ghost hunters have fun out there. And so I'll be speaking there. And, you know, we try to vary the tone, so to speak, and have fun with the people. And I find there is a UFO attitude, if you will. People are interested. They were last year, certainly. And I was very pleased the response to my lecture then. So we're going to try it again. And I was down in Brazil, and they did well down there.
How do they look at the UFO situation there?
Well, they're getting very encouraged by the fact that the Brazilian government has gradually been releasing more and more files, including a lot of secret stuff. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk over the last couple of years about the Ministry of Defense in England, MOD, and the French government and others. Mostly these guys haven't released top secret stuff. They're just trying to get out from under the burden of filling Freedom of Information requests. Well, A.J. Gevaert and others who published the Brazilian UFO magazine, and he's brought me down to Brazil several times. Mm-hmm. He comes to the United States and stuff. And it was well done. We had a full house. I spoke, and they translated, and Robert Hastings was there. You've had...
Yes, we've had him on just on this week.
Gave a good talk on nukes and UFOs, and he and I at least could talk to each other since neither one of us spoke Portuguese. They're interested, and I was surprised. I hadn't fully appreciated the fact that they get a lot of the same, the History Channel and other programs, so I get a lot of people who'd seen me on television. I guess they dub in the Brazilian, Portuguese and stuff. So I've been down there before, and I found that they're very interested. And the same kind of thing happens there, except that the government and generals were there has been more open. And, you know, that's the case with Peru. There was were a couple of people there from Peru and others from other countries. So I found that there's enthusiasm. And it's always good to see that, and it's not being poo-pooed the way maybe it used to be. So it's a long way, I'll say that, and it's a 10-hour flight from Toronto.
Oh, yeah, it sure is. Let's go to some calls here for you, Stan. Let's go to Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Len, get us started. Go ahead, Len.
Yeah, hi, Stan. A lot of people now are reporting UFOs as being light balls or light-shaped objects, as opposed to in the olden days when they were flying saucers. And I wanted to ask you, a lot of the debunkers are saying, well, this is just ball lightning. And I just want to ask you, what conditions do you really have to have for it to be ball lightning? And how can you tell if the UFO you've seen is not ball lightning?
Well, there's several things. And studies have been done years ago. Ball lightning is not a new, quote, solution, unquote, to the UFO problem. Ball lightning doesn't last very long, seconds rather than hours or many minutes. It's relatively small, typically size estimates. People did a couple of surveys at Oak Ridge National Laboratory and at NASA Lewis Labs up in Ohio. The members of the staffs, if they had ever seen ball lightning, what its characteristics were and so forth. This is internal surveys, so they didn't have to worry about external concerns. And papers were published. So, you know, the color, typically blue, the duration, very short, almost always storms involved locally. Ball lightning just doesn't fit. It doesn't play games with airplanes. It doesn't last long. It doesn't look right. This was one of Phil Klass's early solutions, the king of the noisy negativists. And it doesn't pan out when you look at the data on the observations versus the characteristics. And so I'm not saying nobody ever reported something that turned out to be ball lightning. Anything you can think of, somebody once reported. You know. advertising planes and so forth. But ball lightning simply doesn't cut it. Doesn't last long enough. It isn't big enough. It doesn't have windows, for example, and things like that. So it's a trivial solution to the problem. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
First-time caller, Chuck in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Chuck, good morning.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Stanton. Great to talk to you guys. Thanks for all your years of hard work and investigation on this subject. Stan, I had a question. I lived outside of Kecksburg in 1965, Pennsylvania, in a town called Mount Pleasant. And the day that the Kecksburg incident happened, I actually saw that thing come over. I was outside with my dad. And it did make some turns. It was like a fireball. And but what I really wanted to ask you about was around that time, on television, there were a lot of reports of UFOs at the time, and my father and my mother and I were going to leave to go to do some shopping in Greensburg, and there was a show on the TV at the time, and there was a guy who I guess was considered like a UFO expert or whatever, and he was saying at the time that if you saw something in the sky that you thought might be a UFO, and it was at night and you were driving, if you would flash your headlights on and off, that you might get some kind of a reaction out of this thing. And when we were on our way back from Greensburg, we were coming up a pretty good-sized hill up the side of a mountain, and my dad saw three lights that formed like a triangular shape in the sky, and he got out of the car, because we just watched the show, and he flashed the headlights on and off. And every time he did, this thing changed direction. And I was wondering if you have ever heard of any reports of UFOs that would react to a light flicking on and off like that.
Yes, I've heard a number of reports like that, and usually it scares the heck out of the people pushing the switch, so to speak, because it's done with the thought, oh, nothing's going to happen, but let's see, and whoops. Now, I don't know how you reacted, your family reacted, but I'm sure your dad was interested when this thing changed its course in response, apparently, to your lights going on and off. Many people get scared. It's hard to imagine a conventional aircraft reacting that kind of way. You say you stopped the car. Did you hear anything?
I think his phone went on him.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I lived in Pittsburgh for 3 years, so when he says Greensburg, I know. And Stan Gordon is still around that area and doing fine UFO research. He was a young guy when I first knew him. He isn't so young anymore.
Stan, did you ever look at the case of Thomas Mantell, 1948, the Kentucky Air National Guard pilot?
Well, in passing, so to speak, I've looked at the explanations. For people who haven't heard the case before, these guys in the National Guard were flying, and the local military picked up something in the sky, and they redirected these guys to check it out. And Mantell went up, following it, described it as huge and metallic, and he crashed not long thereafter. Now, two separate questions, really. What was he chasing? And one explanation was a skyhook balloon, although huge and metallic doesn't really fit a skyhook balloon. And the second was, why did he crash? Did he run out of oxygen, which he didn't have, supposedly, and was up over 20,000 feet?
Mm-hmm.
You don't last long. One explanation is that it was Venus, which certainly didn't fit the data. And the thing is, there were quite a few observers, military installations in that area. So it's one of those cases that raises a lot of questions and provides few answers. Now, people say, the body was in pieces and stuff like that. I think none of that is true. There's been a lot of exaggeration put out. But the first guy, supposedly anyway, that we know about, to die trying to catch up with the UFO. That might have happened during World War II with the Foo Fighters and stuff like that. We don't know. And again, we go back to General Bolander saying reports which could affect national security are not part of the Blue Book system. The point is the government hasn't come clean. on chases and fatal chases. In the book, Shoot Them Down by Frank Ficino, Jr.,
yep.
He talks about orders were given, and we have proof of that, newspaper articles, et cetera, in 1952 to shoot them down, UFOs, if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, the other side of that coin, I mean, you can think of all kinds of cartoons to go with that, you know.
Absolutely.
But, the other side of that coin is I have heard seven cases independently of each other of pilots going up to chase UFOs and not coming back. And so you wonder if somebody didn't say, some alien didn't say, get off our back, guys, you know. And so you can see where we may have lost a lot of pilots. And I know some people say, what do you mean, Stan? They would have told the families what happened to them. No, that's not true. There's a book, Burroughs is his last name, William Burroughs, B-U-R-R-O-W-S, By Any Means Necessary. And he's a historian and a journalist, and published a book in 2001, and tells the rather sad story of 166 military crew members who died when flying on reconnaissance planes which were tickling North Korea, China, and Russia, mostly in the 40s and 50s. And so they were violating international law often, you know, going within the 12-mile limit and so forth, trying to see how quickly the radar came on, what frequencies were being used. We shot down some Russian planes, too. Anyway, there was not one word in public by us or the Russians or the Chinese or the North Koreans about destroying these planes. We had radio communication from some of the crews. They bailed out. The crews were grabbed. Until 2001, where a national sort of a conference was held, they brought in the families. That's when people found out what happened to their sons, brothers,
right.
fathers, whatever. 166 men we're talking about. Not one word to families or in the public about what had happened to them. Plane lost at sea, unfortunate accident, too bad.
They're gone.
So, you know, how many people, how many planes got destroyed by UFOs? I don't know. But Mantell is one case we did hear about. Whether the UFO had anything to do with it or not, we don't know.
Let's go to Anonymous, a former pilot, Stanton. Let's see what's on his mind. Hi there.
Stanton, you're absolutely correct. I flew for the airlines for 25 years before I retired. And your statement that pilots have seen a lot of things that they don't want to talk about in public usually is absolutely correct. For example, I was flying down to St. Kitts from Dallas one day, and we were out off the East Coast on some of the islands on the way down. There are, you know, lots of islands on the way down to St. Kitts out in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And I looked down in the water over on the co-pilot side of the airplane on a 720. I was flying a 727 at the time, and there were about 50 great big huge white circles laying on the ocean floor in a straight line going out from this small little island. And so I wrote down the GPS coordinates on the aircraft where we were so that we could take a look at it on the way back an hour or two later. And when we came back and we hit the coordinate place where the GPS had the same coordinates, all of them were gone. The co-pilot saw them, the flight engineer saw them, I saw them. Anybody that thinks that UFOs aren't real and that they're from somewhere else is smoking dope. I saw six of them out over the white sands one day flying in formation. It's a big silver craft. Probably 50 or 80 feet. Now the ones down out in the Caribbean were probably 200 or 300 feet across.
Ooh, and big guys.
Oh yeah, and I don't know why they were there. They were there on the way down and gone on the way back, as I said. But the ones out over the white sands, there were six of them flying in formation. I happened to catch them in the corner of my eye as we were flying out to Los Angeles from Houston, and I said, "Look at that." And the co-pilot turned his head, and just as I said that, they disappeared straight up, and as fast, you couldn't even see them, they went up so fast. And it was just unbelievable. So they're absolutely real, and what can I say? You're exactly correct. Now, the pilots typically would talk about it up in the cockpit, and 75% of them would admit that they'd seen them. Now, when you got them on the passenger side of the door, probably only 2 or 3% of them would admit that they'd seen them or anything about it, because the government campaign of convincing everyone that you're crazy if you saw a UFO had been very effective, and none of the pilots wanted to be accused of being crazy. And that's why I didn't give my name, because everybody at the airline that I flew for would know exactly who it was.
Well, I appreciate your calling in, and I've run across that same thing in a group called NARCAP, National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena, something like that, has collected thousands of reports because they've guaranteed the pilots that their names won't be used. But I've talked to people, and, you know, I can't blame a guy. He's got a good job with a major airline.
Sure.
Why would he risk it by going public, and the airline says, what are you, crazy?
Yep.
People won't fly with us if they think our pilots are seeing these crazy saucers. This despite the fact that the polls show, and there's a whole chapter in Flying Saucers and Science about this, they're more believers than non-believers. But most people believe, most other people don't believe, and so they act accordingly.
I wish we had incredible cameras in the cockpits of these planes.
Yeah.
Gosh, we could have. Do you remember the case of that 20-year-old pilot from Australia, the young
Valentich?
Yes, exactly, in a Cessna, reporting back to Mission Control in Melbourne that he was being chased by a 4 bright-lighted UFO 1,000 feet from him. He kept explaining what the object looked like as it was getting closer, and then no contact. He was gone.
I met his father when I was down in Australia. I was very favorably impressed with the father. And, of course, the tape is around of the conversation between him and the flight control
people. And they never found his plane, did they?
No.
No.
No. You wonder if there isn't a museum someplace out there. You know, we've got the Smithsonian with the Lindbergh's plane and stuff.
Yeah. And they've got him now.
Earthling Zoo.
And so many others. Maybe those Avengers and everything else.
Yeah.
You never know.
Who knows?
You never know. Let's go next to Tom, truck driving in Massachusetts, east of the Rockies. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Good.
I always wanted to call you and tell you the story. It was back in 79. I was a junior in high school. Me and my three friends were hanging out in the access area on Lake Wallenpaugh back at the Poconos.
Okay.
Up in Pennsylvania. Now, we were hanging out looking at the sky. There was a bright light up there. It looked like a star, but it was moving around a lot. And it started to move in short. Well, it looked short from, you know, all the way down below, short angles, real quick motions, up, down, sideways. We started paying attention to it now. When it got down lower, we noticed there was a red light on it, but not flashing it. Now, it came down. We're in an elevated parking lot. They call it an access area where you park the cars that overlooks the lake. It came down so low to the water that it was actually in front of the tree line on the water. We had to run down to the beach to get in front of the trees. It got down so low. I'm telling you, George, the lights were shining down on the water, and it didn't make any noise, and my friend was jumping around waving, come on down, come on down.
Jeez.
And there was a little bit of a spectrum of lights on it, and I never got any lower than that. It hung out there for about, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds, a minute, and it started moving off in the direction towards, like, the local ski slope that used to be up there. We got in the car, and we followed it for a little bit, but then it took off, like, in a shot of light. But I wanted to tell you, now, later on, years later, my friend called me up and told me, he goes, look at the front page of the Wayne Independent up there. He says, on the front page, and I read the article, that half the town, or well, not half the town, but there was many observers in Newfoundland, which is on the other side of the lake, witnessed the UFO, and they had a state trooper in there that made a comment on the front page that, yes, we observed the craft in the sky, and we all saw, we don't know what it was, but I was just wondering if there was a lot of sightings reported in the Lake Wallenpaugh back area in Pennsylvania, in that area.
And we should check with the National Reporting Center as well, the National UFO Reporting Center. I'll check that. That could be an incredible story, too. Back with Final Calls with Stanton Friedman next. On our next Coast to Coast program, we'll be talking with David Eagleman. He's a Texas neuroscientist and a writer. And we're going to be talking with him about many things, including 40 Tales from the Afterlives on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Stanton Friedman, our special guest, your phone calls as well. Let's go to Greenville, South Carolina. Alexander, take it away. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello, George Norrie?
It sure is.
This is Alexander. I am a contactee to UFOs. I had a landing in Oceanside, New York in 1952 on the 27th of August, 1952.
That's a long time ago, Alexander.
Yeah, and the man that saved my life was Sonny DeVerges of West Palm Beach, Miami, Florida. He was a scoutmaster.
Yeah.
And he was on his way home from a scout meeting with three boys in the car.
You know this case, Stan?
Yeah, this is a famous case. Some people don't believe him, but there's some strange effects found on the soil and the plants and all that sort of thing. Right.
Tell us more, Alexander. What happened to you?
Well, then I had the flying saucer land on the 27th of August, 1952. It came out of the sky, out of the northeast. It came like a shooting star, like a green flame coming behind each other. And as it came down toward the swamp area, it dropped down like a helicopter, and then there was a bluish-white flash of light. The object changed in colors from bluish-white, bluish-green, reddish-orange, and brightish-white amber. On one side of the craft, it was a red light, and on the other side, there was a blue light that were flashing on and off. In the center, there was an egg-shaped dome, 10 feet high. The disc had about a three-foot V antenna on top of the craft, and a V antenna toward the ground. It hovered above 3 feet off the ground. It made no noise, but you could see the discs themselves. One was going one way, the other one was going the other way, and all the dogs in the area were barking like hell. And all of a sudden, after the motors of the craft stopped, all the dogs just stopped barking. And then I had got an idea. I had signaled the craft with a small flashlight I had. I signaled a dash and three dots. And then I waited. I hesitated. And then all of a sudden, the craft lit up in an amber color, and it on and off, on and off, on and off.
Signaling back to you.
Yes. And then before that, when the craft was in this reddish-orange, you could see the round windows, like porthole windows on a ship, and then you could see a hatchway 3 feet high just on the outside edge of the egg. And the egg had a ladder going around the craft.
Jeez.
Coming down toward the ground. There were three people in the craft.
Now, what do you mean by people?
Well, three people, three little creatures.
Like the typical alien grays that we hear so much about?
Well, no, these guys were dressed in green uniforms. They had blue caps on. They had on the side of the craft, they had the insignia, which was a half moon with a V, with a line running through the middle of the V, and then a line underneath the V.
What did they look like, little humans?
They looked more like, monkeys? But they weren't monkeys.
Okay.
They had large heads, but small bodies. One walked into the swamp. The other man walked between the blue and red lights as if examining. And the other man walked into the craft, and he pointed a rod directly at me. But there was nothing fired.
How did they treat you?
They treated me fine.
And did they keep you for
I've been under surveillance since 1952. Now, I live here in Greenville, South Carolina, in Greenville County. I heard a man on talk to you from Spartanburg.
Yeah,
and he had talked about the thing of the UFOs and everything, but then Stanton Friedman was talking about the case with the UFO in Washington, the thing, and when they come out with the movie UFO, they showed the movie of where the UFOs were over the Washington area on the 19th of July.
Yeah,
and then we're on again. On the 26th, and they sent up jets the first time, they disappeared from the radar. But then, after they sent up another flight from
Dover, but
no,
or Newcastle.
It was from Delaware, Andrews Air Force Base. They sent them up from Andrews Air Force Base. When the UFOs penetrated the area, President Truman was in the White House, and he was sleeping. But the UFO went over the Capitol, hovered over the Capitol for about a few minutes, and then moved back into the right position. And there was about 14 of them appeared on the 26th. There was a 10 flight that passed over in the 19th.
You know, Stan, this case that he was referring to where he was an abductee, was it widely reported on during that time period?
I don't think so. Not that particular case. The Sonny Desverges case was.
It was.
Certainly the 52, that whole summer, it wasn't just the July. There were sightings over Washington. They had the largest press conference they'd had since World War II when General Samford and General Roger Ramey, who was involved in Roswell, were the UFO experts, and they explained it away, temperature inversions and so forth, and the press bought it. But if you talk to people who were there, and people have interviewed the radar operators and so forth, it doesn't fit. And that's why I mentioned Frank Ficino's book, Shoot Them Down, because he goes into the 52 wave. And a lot of people have talked to people who are in the control rooms, and the government got quite concerned, but they were successful in keeping away from revealing what was going on. And, you know, I'm not saying these UFOs were there to land on the White House lawn, but they were sure flying close by.
And there was an incredible picture that I've seen of these UFOs behind the Capitol.
Well, there is a picture that shows up. How legitimate it is, I don't know. But certainly a lot of the sightings were legitimate, no question
sure.
about it. And so that's one of the great episodes. There ought to be a guy who does a PhD thesis on the 52 wave, because there's an enormous amount of material, and now with the internet and stuff, it's a lot easier to find stuff.
Well, isn't it true that Andrews Air Force Base out of Maryland picked up a number of UFOs on radar?
Oh, yeah. There were radar sightings, and there were sightings by commercial airplanes in the area, you know, where the control tower would ask them to look over in a certain direction, and they would see it. Them, whatever you want to call it. It was a great episode, but it didn't get the coverage it deserved. It got enough to get people excited, but they bought into the explanation and sort of dismissively. And matter of fact, one of the cases I mentioned before that I'd heard 7 stories of airplanes disappearing who were chasing UFOs. I'm talking about there was another case that sounded very much like the 52 case, only 50 years later. And I was talking about that on the air and got a call from somebody. He called me later. I mean, I got a number and called him back. He was in the military at Andrews, and he said they weren't just chasing them in July, Stan. That went on for months.
Jeez.
And he mentioned this case of 2 pilots going up, being sent up military to chase a UFO, and one coming back all really shook up. And the only comment he made was it went straight up. And the other the other plane never came back. And he said there was a little article in the paper, plane lost at sea a couple weeks later and stuff. But we ever get a look at those files, and it may be one of the reasons for the cover-up. Who wants to admit that we lost planes, we couldn't do a darn thing? And, you know, that's not something you want to make a big deal out of because you're afraid. Remember, 52, we were in Korea in a little
war. And we were uptight. The Cold War was there.
Yeah, and we suddenly realized that the Russians had been testing nuclear weapons, and they had means for delivering them. They had copied one of our B-29s, and were flying those around. So, and we suddenly realized we didn't have radar coverage of the country. We had the Ground Observers Corps, George.
Yes, we did. Do you remember the 1965 Santa Ana, California picture taken by highway traffic engineer Rex Heflin?
Oh, yes.
It's an incredible picture. The craft is weird looking, but he's taking this picture outside from within his cab outside.
Yeah.
And to me, the strangest part of this photo, Stan, is the disruption of the ground underneath the craft.
That we have to be a little concerned about. That seems to be an area where there was an irrigation pipe. And so the plant growth was different there. But the Heflin case is a good, solid case. Dr. Robert Wood has gotten involved, and Ruffel has gotten involved. The original negative showed up for some reason. I've seen over 100 pages of analysis of those pictures. And Heflin was worked for the state of California. I mean, this is not a guy who's just driving by and wants a little fame. He didn't need it. So, yeah, those pictures are good. It is a weird-looking craft. Looks like a hat. And, you know, the debunkers, anybody can fake that. Well, yeah. Some very careful work was done, and it is not a small little model close to the
that's
car.
Right. And keep in mind, that's 1952. No computers, nothing.
No, that was in the Heflin case was in 64.
64, yeah.
Yeah, but right. Still, right. You, no, you're right, no computers. And I use those pictures in my lecture partly for just that reason. Why don't you use current stuff? I say any 14-year-old with Photoshop can make all kinds of interesting pictures.
Exactly. Would you say that we had better UFO cases back 30, 40 years ago, or are we getting good ones now?
We're getting some good ones now. I'm thinking of Stephenville, for example, with the radar tapes and other ones, and I'm sure this new arrangement with Bob Bigelow is going to bring forth some great investigations that are sort of on target quickly, which is something you like. Remember, looking back, there's a lot of years to look back at. Looking at the present, you're only looking, you know, a short period of time at a time. So I think there are plenty of good cases. The dirty work has been done about putting up the ridicule, keeping the press away from the good stuff, and they don't want to admit that they have ignored it and all that sort of stuff. But I'm interested to see what's going to happen this week at the MUFON conference here and some of the updates from the people who've been at this a long time, and MUFON's projecting a new approach to how to deal with these things. And so, I mentioned early on we need some young people, and it's good to see that John Greenwald will be involved.
He's good.
Yeah, he's got the Black Vault.
The Black Vault, yeah.
Boy, an incredible amount of stuff on the Internet. And he's young. He's under 30, and that, to me, seems terribly young.
Let's go to Salinas, California, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, George?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I have a quick question and a theory for Stanton.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, you know, I never hear any accounts of Harry Truman, you know, during the Roswell incident. Was he shown the bodies or any of the debris?
Well, there are people that Ray Santilli autopsy footage, supposed. My first contact with Ray, somebody had called me. They'd heard a story on an English television program. They'd met me in England a year before. I called some people and eventually talked to Ray, and then I met with him. And he originally said that, I said, you know, I'd like to help here. Can you identify people in the movie and stuff? Because I've been studying that period of time. And he said, oh, Harry Truman's there. I said, oh? And, yeah, the movie was shot in the autopsy was done in Dallas, he said, and he said a whole bunch of other things. I said, oh, you checked with the Truman Library? Yeah, Truman was there. Well, I know the people at the Truman Library, and Truman wasn't in Texas or New Mexico and from May through October. And so Truman was very careful about national security. I do not believe he was in Texas or New Mexico. He has people to do these things. The president, anytime the president travels, it's an awful lot of people who get involved. Remember when Henry Kissinger went to China to set up the visit by Nixon?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kissinger went there in total secrecy, but Nixon didn't.
It was the old ping-pong diplomacy, remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you got it. And what I'm saying is, Truman, I talked to somebody named George Elsie, who I believe is still alive. He worked for Truman the entire time he was in the White House. And I'd sent him the MJ-12 papers and then called him and got his feelings about a lot of things. And I was very careful what I asked him because I suddenly realized if he knows anything, he can't tell me. So I had to ask him questions he could answer. None of the documents fraudulent, but you see anything about them that would lead you to believe that they're not true, you know, that he could answer, et cetera. And he made a point of saying how concerned Truman was with security. That Truman was careful in what he said, but he had people like George Marshall to talk to. He had his military people. Sidney Sowers, who was the first executive secretary of the National Security Council, a buddy of Truman, if you will, and he served. He was head of the CIA at one time, and so we don't know, except for the fact that an air attaché has told about Truman asking him to keep him briefed on this subject. But if Truman was talking to people like General Marshall, like General Vandenberg, who at that time was the vice head of the Air Force, so they changed the name in there someplace about chief of staff and so forth, and James Forrestal, Secretary of Defense, we don't know. And for people who think all that stuff's been declassified, Stan, that's nonsense.
No.
The Eisenhower Library still has a 250,000 pages of classified stuff.
2 minutes to go. Los Angeles we go. Doug, let's see if we get you in. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi.
Hey. I really like to face this show tonight. You and Stan and George, y'all seem to be so relaxed together.
Sure.
really enjoyed listening to it.
Good.
Anyway, I'm calling about back to 1969, I guess we'll bring it in there. There was an instrument developed in Fort Worth, Texas, at the a school there, radio students. And they made an instrument like a one-square-meter emission grid, a double layer with slits and louvers, and actually made contact in 69. And these two guys, Palmer and Davis, they called the NASA, and the NASA said stuff like, they were trying to get them to come up there and look through this instrument. It was called the Air Transducer, an audio image receiver, AIR, transducer, transponder, transcender. And NASA would never come. They just made jokes, said, what have you guys been drinking? Or, you know, they never showed. Anyway, I went all the way up through the NASA, all the way in America, then over to the Coast Bar in Europe in 94.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that, maybe some scientists, and I was in the E-Commission there, high energy physics, and because in 69, we developed the instrument in 69, and in about 70, a guy named Ivan Strong, he detected these things, gamma ray bursts, but his first opinion was that they were communications.
I love that. Stanton, we're all out of time. Did you ever hear anything about this?
Many of the early reports, the pulsars, neutron stars, other things, their initial thought was, since this is periodic information, it must be artificial. Turns out Mother Nature's got some surprises in store for us. So there's a lot that went on that we don't know about and that I don't know about. Sorry.
Those of you who want to be in Denver this weekend, Mutual UFO Network Conference, Stanton Friedman will be there. More info on that on his website, which is linked up with coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.